We're in the studio with John Sinclair, noted poet and hellraiser, I would say.
Ne'er-do-well.
Ne'er-do-well. I like that. I like that. So you're living in Detroit these days.
Yeah. I've got a physical problem, so the Detroit Medical Center takes care of me at the government's expense because I'm old.
How is it at how is it living in Detroit now? You've been on Amsterdam and New Orleans and stuff.
Yeah, well, Amsterdam is like living in civilization, and Detroit is like the opposite.
So you're here for Detroit Week, though. But,
yeah.
And so you're
Detroit Week looks good in Denver. You strip away the miles of abandoned houses and storefronts and the empty fields.
I've seen a website called Abandoned Detroit. I was stunned.
Yeah.
I was just stunned.
A friend of mine, the great artist Lowell Boileau, used to have a website called The Fabulous Ruins of Detroit in the 90s. It was just stunning.
But on the upside, there's all these artists moving in, you know. That's what I hear. There's an influx of art and music and stuff.
I don't know.
So they say, you know, they like to put
I don't think it's the same kind that we're talking about.
Yeah.
It's new white people is what I call them. They don't even know where they are.
Yeah.
They give them the really good jobs, and they move there, and they give them money down on their residence. It's a real white people thing, you know, from top to bottom.
Yeah.
So they've got all that white people music that I really don't want to hear, period. And I don't really call it art either, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm trying to get paid.
I'm just hearing about it from the distance.
From I came up under. Where it wasn't about getting paid, it was about self-expression, you know.
Sure.
I'm still at that juncture, so.
Well, I'm glad about the self-expression.
I don't mean to be a negative chamber of commerce, but the whole thing is so offensive to me because you got, well, there's only 650,000 left, but you got 600,000 black people there. They don't have any jobs for them. The schools are so terrible that now that they have jobs, they can't give them to Detroiters because they haven't trained them to do anything. Mm. So it's really ugly to me. It's unrelenting ugliness to me. And I resent having to be there, but my doctor won't let me go back to Amsterdam, so I better.
That's because that's where you were from back in the day originally or something?
Yeah, well, my daughter and my granddaughter are there.
Yeah.
They take care of me while I'm there.
So how did it happen you hooked up, you're a poet, and then you hook up with the MC5, you know? How did that?
I was just lucky.
Just happened, huh?
I heard this band. They were great. So I went to hear them play every time. They played for a year. And then I took over their chores of management.
Yeah.
Having the car there on time.
Yeah.
Buying the guitar strings, the drumsticks.
Doing all that management.
Repairing the amplifiers.
Yeah.
So nothing very glamorous about managing a local band. But fun, though. Wouldn't trade it for the world.
Yeah. And
they were so great. It was an honor to be associated with them. That's the way I felt.
Sure. Well, I mean, that's one of my favorite
bands. I was with Wayne Kramer two nights ago in New Orleans.
Oh, no kidding.
Huh. Yeah, Wayne is an activist. He has this beautiful program called Jail Guitar Doors. Where they shake down instrument companies for guitars and then they give them to convicts.
Oh, that's
great.
And
then they go into prison and they teach them how to play and how to write a song and stuff like that. It's really a great program.
No doubt.
So he was doing all. I got another friend in New Orleans, Billy Taylor. He runs the Trombone Shorty Foundation. But also he and Anders Osborne have a thing where they're both recovered alcoholics, and so they have a program to help other people in the music business, and musicians mostly, who have alcohol problems. They'll help them.
That's
so great. These are great. So they brought Wayne into the New Orleans. It was a beautiful thing.
I hear you, man.
Because, you know, Donald J. Trump ain't going to do this.
No Yeah. We could do about 2 hours.
No.
You know, I could.
He's not worth it.
No, totally not. You're my first Supreme Court person. You know, you had that case about the Supreme Court.
I won in the Supreme Court.
Yeah, yeah. And so thank you for that. Thanks for your services,
great honor.
I say. You know,
I've become friends with my judge in Detroit, too, Damon J. Keith, now about 95.
Wow.
But when I see him, he introduces me to the people around him and says, this is the guy who made me famous. Yeah, U.S. versus U.S. District Court ruling that there's no such thing as a national security wiretap, that you must have a warrant according to the U.S. Constitution.
Oh, okay.
That was our case.
Yeah.
Nixon and John Mitchell and a guy named William Rehnquist, who was in their Justice Department, they developed this concept.
They were very fond of wiretapping.
Well, they didn't think you should have to have a warrant because, after all, so many of these judges were pinkos.
Yeah.
And so if you went to them for a warrant to wiretap some other pinkos, they would just call them up and tell them, so you couldn't really, you wouldn't be safe. That was really their reasoning.
Yeah, yeah.
Ooh.
So as a poet, you work more with musicians. You do more of the recording thing. I mean,
that's my idea.
And you might, you know, you and Ken Nordine were the guys that that started doing that
stuff.
He
just passed away.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he did. And you guys are both heroes to me because it kind of lit the way. I was like, I'm a poet and I do music. And it's So it's
I got it from Jack Kerouac.
Well, yeah, Jack with the Steve Allen show.
Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who just turned 100.
Yeah, yeah, we celebrated his birthday.
Oh, you
Sunday.
Did?
Yeah.
Good idea.
Yeah, we played a bunch of his stuff from in the cellar. And
The cellar, that was an original influence on me. Well, yeah. I was a bebopper.
Yeah.
And I loved the music. And before that, I was a rhythm and blues fanatic as a teenager. I grew up in the rock and roll period.
Sure.
I had Tutti Frutti and Maybelline when they came out.
Man,
I'm
Chuck.
Specialty in chess, 45.
Is Chuck Berry a poet or what?
Yeah, he was the greatest.
Yeah, really a great
poet. Well, and also he created the unity between the great poems, the lyrics, and the music. So the music drove the poetry to a higher level, you know.
So was that always a thing with you when you were writing poetry? You were like, I'd rather do this with music, or was it on the written page? Or,
oh, no, I always wrote. No, I was inspired by Lawrence Ferlinghetti and Allen Ginsberg initially, City Lights books, and then Kerouac. Well, I was originally inspired by On the Road when I was a sophomore in high school.
Yeah.
And that's when I wanted to be a beatnik. I read that book, and that was what I wanted.
My mom and
dad
were beatniks.
There was no way that I could figure out how to do it, but that was the idea. It was laid out so beautifully by Kerouac. And then a couple years later, I got turned on to Ferlinghetti and then Ginsberg. And that was the first time I saw any poetry that I liked.
Yeah.
And then I went on from that. My major influence was Charles Olson, Robert Creeley, and then Mary Baraka.
Yeah. We just did a thing with Robert Creeley on recordings, you know.
Oh, very good.
So, yeah. Man.
He was a great American. He was a very good friend of mine.
Yeah.
And an idol to me.
Want to also talk about the John Sinclair Foundation. Are you still, is that still happening?
Well, yeah. I'm trying to. Well, it's in progress. Yeah.
Yeah, that's where you're.
I don't have any idea what I'm doing, but. My idea is I want to put all of my. Well, I don't own anything, but intellectual properties,
mm-hmm.
and my idea is to transfer all of my intellectual properties to my foundation, so they'll be preserved, and so then I got some young people in Amsterdam and here in the States who understand what I'm trying to do.
Sure.
Not so many. But once in a while, you get one. And so I press them into service. And I want to affect this transfer and then leave it up to them to exploit these resources and pay for themselves to do the work and pay for editions to be published and all that. I want to keep my work alive beyond my physical term. You know?
I don't think there's any danger of it going away, sir. I got to
tell you. I don't know. It hasn't
gone
that far.
As long as I'm here, I'll be playing it. You know.
Well, yeah. So. It's always a thrill to meet a person like yourself because there aren't that many, quite frankly.
Well, yeah. It's good to keep poetry alive.
I do this because it's what I want to do, not because there's a public demand for it.
Mm.
Well. So I was so thrilled when Austin asked me to come here for Detroit Week. This doesn't happen very often. Usually I have to call people and beg them to let me come, you know.
Well, we're glad to have you here, and I'm so stoked about it, I can't tell you.
Oh, man, thanks.
Is there a, like, do you know a website for the John Sinclair Foundation or anything like
that?
Yeah,
.org.
.org, just John Sinclair Foundation.
My website is johnsinclair.us.
Okay.
And then my radio station, which is radiofreeamsterdam.org.
And people can hear you on there, definitely.
Yeah, I do my own show every week, and I play one of my shows from the archives every week, and then I got 12 other disc jockeys.
Right on.
Including from Boulder, Colorado, Kerry Wilson, the Red Rooster.
Oh, no kidding.
He's on my radio station.
Oh, right on.
I put up 2 hours of unique programming every day.
Yeah. That's fantastic. Glad to
hear
that.
That's how I have my fun, my old age.
Yeah, yeah.
Keeps me out of trouble.
So how does it work with the band? How is it just chance meetings or people you know, or do you have something in mind when you're going to record, your stuff? Or
all of the above.
Falls together?
All of the above.
Yeah?
I don't know. In Detroit, I have a band that I've had since the early 80s. McMurray has recently joined my band on tenor saxophone, often the second tenor, which is my ideal.
You're working with a band down at Dazzle?
We'll have two. I brought Tom Worrell with me from New Orleans. We're musical partners down there, and he used to live here, so he knows he knows what to do in the environment.
Awesome.
So one night we're going to have one band, and one night we're going to have another one.
Oh, great.
We're going to play blues, and the other we're going to play jazz.
Sweet. That's going to be great.
And again, one night, my mind isn't so sharp on actual dates and what have you.
That's okay. I'll take care of the dates.
On one of these nights, the great Thornetta Davis is going to perform after us.
Awesome.
The blues queen of Detroit.
Yeah,
she's
that's
a monster.
I'm so stoked about all these musicians
I've
coming
been listening
in.
I've listened to her since she was 15 years old, and they called her Girl Thornetta.
Well, yeah. Again, we're talking with John Sinclair, and he's going to be down at Dazzle on Thursday and Friday night for Detroit Week. And if we can, it'd be an honor to have you, do a piece or two.
Oh, yeah, I brought Tom Worrell. I got him out of bed, made him come out here.
Yeah, it's early for wake up.
For us.
It's a little early. Yeah.
It's early for everybody.
Early is good. Keeps the mind out of the way.
Yeah, right. Right. Okay, well, let's do Rhythm and Ning, if you would.
Okay.
This is a baseball fantasy in verse that I always like to do at this time of the year, particularly because it's opening day is right around the corner. So let's offer this. It's written to the Thelonious Monk composition called Rhythm a Ning. Thank you. It's the top of the fifth. Two men on and Monk on the mound to face the meat of the defending champion, New York Tenors, batting order. It's the rhythm, inning, time now to get something going. And at the plate for the Tenors, digging in deep now, center fielder Sonny Rollins, also known as Nuke for his remarkable resemblance to the great Don Newcomb, is taking his cuts. Rollins checks the sign from Arnett Cobb at third and takes a called first strike right down the middle. On the base paths, the leadoff batter, Johnny Griffin, dances off second, and James Moody takes a short lead off of first. On deck, the cleanup hitter, fellow native of North Carolina, veteran of many hard seasons in the minor leagues, John Coltrane picks up his bat, weights it, and pounds the air without mercy. Monk checks the runners, shakes off the sign from Art Blakey behind the plate, nods, stretches, and delivers a most wicked curve, and Nuke strikes air. The fans know if Monk can get past Rollins, there'll be one down, Coltrane up, and Coleman Hawkins waiting on deck. So Monk looks in, puts that Rocky Mount grip on the ball, and sends Nuke back to the bench with a deadly screwball. Train fans, and Bean dribbles one down to John Burks Gillespie at first. Diz steps on the bag, and Monk puts another inning away toward an eventual shutout of the defending champs. We'll let Tom Worrell eat up a couple of innings now. In the bottom of the eighth, Miles Davis is hit by a pitch, steals second. Bud Powell draws an intentional pass, and Bird puts the game away with a three-run homer. The series goes to the challengers, the Bebop All-Stars, 4-3, and Monk is voted most valuable player over Dizzy Gillespie in the closest of votes. The year is 1954. The legendary Subway Series is now history, and baseball, dear friends, will never be the same. Yeah.
Wow.
Opening day.
I can't hear him at all, so it's hard for me to.
Yeah.
Can we turn him up in here or some kind of way?
My headphones.
Klaus is coming in. He's
the old fashioned way, headphones. Cool beans, though.
That was nice.
I can't really hear you, though. I know. I'm vibing off of your
movements.
I didn't know it was going to be so.
Oh, he's got a monitor, huh? Isn't that cool?
Okay, cool.
Wow. Slick.
Yeah, we have bands coming here and playing everything, you know. not only famous folks like yourself, but we get students in here, schools and that's colleges good. And stuff like that, you know.
Awesome. Yeah, I heard the McMurray last night on the radio.
Yeah.
That was incredible.
That's, you
that
know.
Incredible.
Oh, my God. Renetta's playing here on Saturday.
Yeah, she's
Saturday, yeah, okay.
She's here 3:15 to 4.
Okay.
In the studio.
Okay, is that when she's at the club?
Yeah.
Oh, I've compressed something in my mind.
She plays Friday and then again on Saturday night.
Okay, she's after us on Friday.
Right.
I got it. And then she, then James is Sunday and Monday. Mm. Okay, now. Phew, now it all makes sense. And Tornetta's Two Gays, that's good. That gives me something to look forward to.
Sweet.
I love Tornetta Davis, man. It was like we say in Detroit, I love me some Tornetta Davis.
So do you want to do another one? Have you got something
sure.
else in mind since
I
he's got the headphones?
Of them.
There you go. We'll keep going as long as you want to go, sir.
Oh, Tom, how about a slow blues?
All right. Always into the blues.
I'll do two or three things on top
okay.
of it. Boy, I just don't have any curse words in here. I can't remember if I do or not. If I do, you'll beat me, right? Okay. They all the same to me, you know. Until my dues card is punched up on all four sides. A child of relative privilege who chose to take the way of the lowest. Beatnik, dope fiend, poet provocateur, race traitor and renegade. Living from hand to mouth and euro to euro, sleeping on the couches and extra beds of my friends, a man without a country and a post office box in New Orleans for a permanent address, a laptop computer and a prepaid Vodafone. One suitcase stuffed with clothing and a bag full of manuscripts and hand-burnt CDs. To keep my head straight and my heart right, to keep up my travels and carry on the struggle into another new taking my little verses and great big world outlook everywhere people will have me. Robert Lowell said, Living without you is like learning to walk. But twice now I've had to learn to walk. And living without you in my life is a much harder proposition. More difficult indeed than simply growing old alone. But how old can a man get who has already lived twice as long as he ever intended? Each day is a whole new thing, never before contemplated or even imagined, but a gift from the gods who administer our sentences with their twisted sense of humor. And when the Beatles asked the question so long ago, will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64? The answer, of course, is not at all the one I'd expected. But I'll keep on living as long as I can and make the most of it as best as I am able. Washed in the love of my daughters and my incredible granddaughter and my thousands of friends and countless co-conspirators wherever I go. That old man, still alive and kicking with both feet. Any day can be the lucky one, or the one with your number written all over it. 1, 2, 3, 5, 0, 7 in the poet's case, walking out the front door of the penitentiary 47 years ago last December. 40 plus 7 years, a cycle of struggle to make it through in one piece, on the yard or in these streets. Anyone who can pick up a frying pan owns death, Burroughs said. And sometime in New York City, coming home from the recording studio, walking up to his front door, John Lennon with a gun stuck in his face. Oh, oh, sweet giant of song, with heart of huge dimension and eyes deep in the sky. There has to be a day when each of us must pass beyond this tedious fear to enter some wondrous place of which we do not know whether we're ready or not. Some other place or space out of time where no punk with a weapon will ever press you again or blow up your face out of the depths of his madness. No one will hold us against our will in a cell with bars in front and back for feet by 6 feet by 8 feet high. No one will take us out of our natural lives and send us away from here by means of some murderous fantasy in which we are denied everything we have lived for. Oh, please let us die at the end of our own time and not before. Free in our world of strife, let us have life as long as we can. And please let there be men like Monk and John Lennon to share of their hearts and light up our ways as long as we may live. They say one day in the early 60s, after Timothy Leary turned him on to LSD, Allen Ginsberg went up to Monk's place in the West 60s to introduce the great master to the wonders of modern chemistry, and left Monk with a dose of the excellent product of the Sandoz Laboratories all the way from Switzerland. To check up on Thelonious, Monk opened the door as far as the chain would allow, peered out at Ginsberg, and asked with a slight frown, "Man, have you got any more of this stuff? So far, it don't seem to be making too much of a difference to me." Monk in orbit. Tom Worrell at the piano.
That blows my mind, Monk on acid.
Yeah.
That's like...
Well, you know, that was a true story. Ginsberg verified it for me.
Wow.
But he also gave acid to Dizzy Gillespie Robert Lowell took acid. It's all part of Leary's experiment. And he gave Ginsberg a supply and asked him to go around in New York City and turn all the important people on and see what happened. Olson took acid. And he wrote about it in this impenetrable essay that's in the first volume of the Psychedelic Review, as I recall.
I remember psychedelics well.
Yeah, of course. You know, don't we, though?
Oh. Hey, one more question. You were a journalist back in the day.
I'm still a journalist.
Well, I mean, let me ask you about journalism.
And per se?
Today, what today. It's facing and your thoughts about that.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, to me, it's just writing, you know?
Yeah.
You have to sit down and make one word come out after another one until you said what you wanted to say.
In the light of the whole...
I'm an underground, you know, I published in, I never wrote for pay.
Yeah.
I mean, I wrote for pay in later years, but...
Yeah.
When we had the Underground Press, nobody ever got paid. When we had the Artist Workshop, which is a performance and educational center, no one ever got paid. No one paid to get in, you know. It was a different world.
Yeah, yeah.
Now I went through the journalism where you paid you to write about. I write about music mostly.
Yeah.
And I edited the Blues magazine that came out of Boulder, Colorado for Kerry Wolfson called Blues Access. I was his managing editor for about 3 years. And I wrote a lot. I wrote for underground papers and that. So I don't really have any experience with the New York Times, the New Yorkers.
Yeah, the it was the Fifth Estate, was it?
Yeah, in Detroit.
Yeah, yeah.
I joined them in their second issue.
Who do you listen to music? When you listen to music now, if you just want to relax and listen to music, who are you listening to these days?
Well, I got my own radio station.
Yeah.
With 12 of my favorite disc jockeys. So I listen to my live stream.
Yeah.
Night and day.
There you go.
Because they never play a record that I don't like. And they play records that I would never play. So it's a good experience for me.
Right on.
Awesome. Otherwise, I just play Miles Davis.
yeah.
Muddy Waters, you know, the essentials. I still listen to all that.
Yeah. There was you just reminded me, there was an album Miles did. It was some soundtrack for a movie that, as usual, the soundtrack was better than the movie. He did a Miles with John Lee Hooker.
Oh, yeah.
And Taj Mahal. That was,
yeah, it was a good record.
Yeah, it's really a nice, it was nice hearing Miles working with John Lee Hooker. That was something.
Well, you can always hear that in his playing, though.
Yeah, yeah.
If you read his autobiography, written with the great Quincy Troupe,
yeah,
he says that's this picture of sound that he has in his mind is blues in the nighttime out in the country.
Wow.
He says that since he was a kid, that was what he hears, you know, that's the ambiance his mind. It says we know he had one of the greatest minds of the 20th century.
Totally.
Well, oh, what a great American Miles Davis was.
Oh, yeah. You know, I remember the scooter commercials. He says, well, I'll tell you about the scooter, but first I'll play. And maybe I'll tell you about the scooter.
Yeah.
He never did. He just sit on the scooter. I like that. Well, listen, it's been...
That was good. Didn't Howlin' Wolf, they had... Was that the same? I don't watch TV, so...
I think it was.
But I remember Howlin' Wolf had a commercial and William Burroughs had a commercial.
Yep.
And that was how most people heard of them.
Duh. Yeah.
They didn't have no copy of Smokestack Lightning on Chess 1645, you know.
Smokestack Lightning.
You dig?
For me, it was Howlin' Wolf with the Stones. You know, that album when those guys went over to London.
Oh, yeah.
And recorded with all those British guys.
That was another great thing when they went on Shindig, one of those horrible teen shows, and they said, "We'll go, but we have to. You have to bring Howlin' Wolf with us."
And they that's I remember that. America. Yeah, yeah.
That's what I loved about those guys, man.
Yeah.
They introduced Stevie Wonder to white America. They introduced Ike and Tina Turner. When they tried to introduce Prince at a show in Los Angeles, the people booed him off the stage.
That's crazy.
That's when I knew it was all
And then
over
those
that.
People would be the same
he
ones.
He was the only interesting thing of his period.
Yeah. And those same people would say,
view.
"Oh, I saw Prince back with
yeah,
the
right,
Stones."
Right,
yeah,
right,
they'd be all, you know.
They had the Stooges open for him in Detroit at Pontiac Silverdome, and they got booed off, too.
Wow.
And then the worst one I saw was The Who. They had Toots and the Maytals, and they booed them off.
Wow.
Could you imagine what kind of Americans could boo off? They probably voted for Trump. Toots and the Maytals, one of the greatest musical groups of all time.
So how's your relationship with Peter Townsend after the Abbie Hoffman
Well, I don't
thing?
Have any. I don't know him personally.
Yeah. There was that story, you know, where Abbie got up on the stage at Woodstock.
Well, Abbie was wrong, but, I mean, he was trying to help me out.
Yeah, so. Sure, sure. But and then later John Lennon and his group had that benefit for you and all that stuff.
Well, they played that to benefit.
Yeah.
We produced the benefit.
Ah. Well, John, it's been
quite frankly,
it's been such a gas to have you
oh,
here.
Oh, my pleasure.
You know, and again, everybody, Detroit Week continues.
Hope I'll see you at the club tonight.
Not tonight. I'm playing music tonight, but I'll be there Friday.
Okay.
You know, I got a gig.
That's good.
They're so few and far between,
Amen.
So I jump on them. You
Amen.
Know? But yeah. We'll be happy to have you there, and folks, come down and see John for the next couple nights down at Dazzle Denver.
That's
down,
right.
Down there at 15th and Curtis in the Bowers Building, and thanks again for coming.
You'll
in
be glad to know Tom Morrow will also be with me.
Yeah, and a big hand for Tom, definitely.
Yes.
You know. All righty. Well,
thanks.
let's wrap it up, huh? Thanks a bunch, man. Really appreciate it.
Good to be here on KUVO.org.
Thank you so much.
I got it on in my hotel room right now.
All right.
But they put the record button on before I left, so I guess I won't get this.
Well, I'll get you a copy.
It was a good idea.
Well, we'll get you a copy.
Fortunately, with the computer, it doesn't cost anything. It's like burning up three $25 rolls of tape, you know, like you used to do.
Man.
All right. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Thank you.